The following is a presentation of Second City Works, delivered by your earbuds at WGN Plus.
Welcome to the Second City Works Getting to Yes And. I'm Kelly Leonard, Executive Director of Insights and Improvisation at the world-famous Second City Theater. This podcast is about navigating work and life without a script. Improvisation is a practice in collaborating more effectively, tapping into your full creative potential, and building ensembles who can both support and challenge us. If you like what you hear, please rate us on iTunes and share the podcast through your social media channels. Help us extend the conversation. This is Getting to Yes And.
Working all day for a mean little man with a clip on tight and a rub on tan. He's got me running around the office like a dog around a track. But when I get back home, you're always there to rub my back. Hey, Julie.
My guest today on Getting to Yes And is Sarah Spain. Sarah's a Peabody Award-winning radio host, TV personality, and writer. She is one half of the Spain and Fitz radio show, airing weeknights on national ESPN radio. She's a writer for ESPNW.com, host of ESPN's That's What She Said podcast. She's a regular panelist on Around the Horn and a SportsCenter reporter. She grew up in Lake Forest, Illinois. That's where I went to college. And went on to Cornell University, where I went to college for 1 year across the gorge at Ithaca, not as good a university. And she excelled as a student athlete. Sarah Spain, welcome to the show.
You got everything right. That's impressive.
All right. Well, you know, I tried to do some research. So one of the reasons I was so interested in talking to you is that you've shown this sort of incredible strength and poise in speaking your truth in this often faceless horde of trolls that swarm social media these days. And I was reminded of a quote from Lindy West in her great book, Shrill. And she writes, "I know that trolls are fundamentally sad people. I know that I've already defeated them in every substantive area by being smart, by being happy, by being successful, by being listened to, by being loved." Does that resonate for you, or is there other stuff going on?
No, it absolutely does. You know, I think, first of all, a lot of times when people react to me reacting to trolls, they'll say, "Why do you even respond to them? They're just looking for attention." And I usually let them know that, you know, many, many, many are just being muted and blocked and ignored. I sort of pick the ones that I want to respond to.
Right.
And then they rarely make me angry. It's usually a combination of disappointment and sympathy. So I absolutely agree with Lindy that usually what I'm thinking is, I kind of feel sorry for this person because they must be deeply dissatisfied with their life and with what's going on around them, their friends and family, and it should make you happy and satisfied if they feel like they're wanting to reach out to others and attack them and make them feel bad. And then in other cases, I don't think that they want to make me feel bad. They just have deeply antiquated and terrible and damaging ideas about where women belong and when they should be listened to.
Yeah.
And in that case, it's just a matter of me wanting to use them as an example for others so that if anybody shares those terrible opinions, or if anyone's in the middle and they're not really sure how to feel, just give them another option by responding to the terribleness with a perhaps more enlightened approach.
Right. And I think you point out a really important distinction, which it is at least it's those two different kinds. One, which are people who are the sort of true trolls who are probably in some sort of deep isolation, disconnected from the world. And I think the fact that you engage with them is a bit of a public service, right? A kind of a kindness that at least someone is willing to engage, even as weird as that might be. And the other is just good old fashioned sexism, right? And you know,
you
wrote in an article I read that in a lot of ways, sports radio is the last bastion of the old boys club. And there's more old boys clubs, right? They're in Hollywood. They're certainly in comedy and elsewhere. But man, sports radio feels like you are battling uphill in that one.
Yeah, I really think, especially local sports radio, I find so many examples that pop out into blogs or newspaper articles about radio hosts that are suspended or fired or given a slap on the wrist sometimes for blatant acts of misogyny or homophobia or ways in which they're completely alienating a majority of human beings that could be their audience because they believe that the people that they're talking to are just straight, white, middle-aged dudes because that's most of the men who are given those jobs.
Right.
And if they said those things on TV or if they wrote them in an article, people would care. But because it's radio, and even though it's captured a podcast and you can go back and find it now, it does have this sort of ethereal feeling to it where you say it and it disappears out into the world. And in some ways, that's great. You can have a lot of fun, and maybe you don't have to be as stressed out as when you publish something and you need to make sure every little bit is right. You know, you can have a little more leeway. But it also allows for this sort of, like I said, wild, wild west, where if you're a woman, a sports fan, most markets are going to have some radio shows where you just don't feel like you're invited at all. And for whatever reason, a lot of the developments and advancements and evolutions that have occurred in other areas of the field have not quite made it to sports radio just yet. And I think in some ways I compare sports radio to the game of baseball. Everybody acknowledges that the major fans of baseball are aging out, right? That it's not as popular amongst younger demographics. So how do they change that? How do they appeal to younger folks? How do they make sure the game is palatable to a new generation? I don't think sports radio does that enough. No. I think they're so worried about clinging to the fans that they already have that they are rather not try to appeal to anyone else at the risk of losing them than, you know, which is such a business model. So I don't think anybody else is so kind of dense to the fact that they need to be a little bit more diverse, have a diversity of voices and experience and perspectives, and that might allow more people to feel like they're welcome to join in.
So I can kind of speak to this from my sort of comedy world, and I know you're a comedy fan. So, I've worked at Second City. It'll be 30 years come October 1st. Mm. So I started producing in 92. And, you know, when I started working at Second City in 1988, it was really homophobic. It was highly sexist. The cast were usually four white straight men and two females, one of whom was cute and the other was ethnic looking. And that was like the prototype. But I was also lucky enough to be a very young person going, this doesn't look like what I understand the progressive politics of a place like this is supposed to be, and was around for the formation of our first outreach division. But, you know, I look back and I'm like, you know, while we were definitely trying to do the right thing, we didn't know how to do it. We didn't always do it very well. And while we got some diversity, we certainly didn't get equity, and I think we sort of barely got inclusion. And I think it's starting to work better now, but, you know, that's the field I was in. It's a field I am in. And I think one of the problems with, and I'm a 52-year-old white straight man, is, you know, not sort of allowing myself to sort of just live in the shame of that, but also go, nope, that was wrong. Things have changed. Both things can be true. Let's listen. Let's hear one another. And let's try to adapt instead of going right to our fear brain. And I know there's not enough people doing that stuff.
Yeah, I completely agree. I think there's many aspects of looking at comedy, the internet, books, magazines, just the society in general, where you can look back and say, this used to be this way, and so it should still be okay, right? Mm-hmm. And that people kind of eulogizing when comedy was still funny, right? And the same goes for sports. When people say, you know, I like when my sports radio was just sports and not politics and not people's opinions. And in fact, it was as much a conversation about life and other topics before. It just was only straight white dudes having it, so it felt like your conversations, right? If you introduce, in a lot of places, it feels like hiring a person of color or a woman is in itself a political act before they've even said or done anything. In fact, they could represent the same exact viewpoints and opinions, and you still believe that you are somehow trying to make a statement merely by having them exist. Mm-hmm. So that's a problem to start with. But then beyond that, when they do try to shed a light on different experience or background or perspective, it feels like an invasion of a space that was previously safe to people who don't understand what it's like to go through the world without having every space open and included to them. And I think there is a necessary reconciliation with what came before. And even for me, I've had women on my podcast, and one of the things I like to talk about in women in my industry is sort of the inevitable pivot. And that is to say that when you get into the industry, you are likely going to be in a primarily male-dominated job, any spot that you're working in. And usually the best approach when you start out is to blend in, right? To be one of the guys.
Yeah.
And you hear a lot of women especially coming up like, oh, well, most of my friends are guys, and I'm not like a girl, right? And like we kind of put down the idea of being female because it feels like the only way to get embraced is to say, oh, I'm not like those girls. I'm one of the guys. And jump right in when they're making sexist jokes and be okay with being surrounded by internet blogs and content that sort of degrades you.
Yeah.
And then once you establish a certain voice and agency, if you choose to make the pivot and you decide it's more important to me to make it better and to change things than it is to have as high a percentage of men want to grab a beer and talk sports with me, if you choose the latter or the former, then you realize that you have a real power to try to make things better, even subtly. And so I've had a lot of women come on and say they have to acknowledge, you know, that they at one time are part of the cog that was creating content that was buying into that. Whether that's here's the hot girl that's dating your favorite quarterback, or cracking a joke about, you know, when a girl wants to play fantasy football and ruins it. You know, that kind of tired old BS. And so I think we have to, though, acknowledge that all of that existed before, and anybody who peddled in it wasn't a wholly wrong person, but they have been given time to evolve and get better. If they have, then we should celebrate that and put the other stuff behind us. We don't have to run away from the fact that it was there.
Yeah.
We should just be holding other people accountable who have not yet decided that it's time to move in to 2018.
Yeah. Yeah. We were just talking about this at lunch at Second City today. Someone had gone to see Isle of Dogs, a new Wes Anderson film. And I love Wes Anderson, but he's getting a lot of crap for appropriating.
Too.
Yeah. He's appropriating potentially Japanese culture. There's some issues maybe
right.
with that. And the guy was the gentleman I was talking to was reacting very poorly to that idea. And I'm like, well, wait, I mean, think about it. In Second City, you know, we've retired classic great Second City scenes because the word we use, you can no longer say because the word has changed. And that doesn't mean that the people who wrote this were wrong or had any sort of malice in their heart. It's just that times have changed. And the way you sort of framed that sort of evolution, I saw in my 15-year-old daughter. I saw it both ways. She was the only girl on the flag football team in grade school.
Right. Yeah.
And she said, she very proudly said, hey, I was made an honorary boy because I'm the only girl. And then like a week later, she's like, I really don't like this honorary boy bullshit, I think is what she said to me.
Nice. She made the move.
So I'm curious, with you, like you grew up in Lake Forest, right? Like how did your... sort of POV on this stuff. How did it get established? How did it evolve? Did it change? Did you always sort of have this leaning and it sort of, you know, at Cornell maybe, you know, synthesized itself or what's that path?
Yeah, it's interesting because I try to look back and figure out, I think, you know, a big part of it is that my mom and dad are both lawyers and they're partners in a law firm together. My mom is just a super badass. She, you know, combines being a full-time lawyer with running 5Ks and beating the women that are, you know, four age groups younger than her. And she can literally pick, like, reeds and blitz them and weave a basket or make a quilt or cook a gourmet meal. Like, she's basically Superwoman. She is the truest Renaissance woman, right?
Mm-hmm.
And she and my dad they have traditional gender roles in that she still is the homekeeper.
Yeah.
But beyond that, they are equal partners in a law firm who are, you know, truly inspirational and even in the way that they've inspired me career-wise and everything else. And so I think I always grew up not feeling like there was anything a woman couldn't or shouldn't do.
Mm-hmm.
And I was 6 feet tall by the time I was 12. So
wow.
I basically was just destroying people in sports. And I had to come to terms with my physical... The way I was physically imposing, the only way to own it, and my parents would often tell me, don't slouch, it'll look like you're uncomfortable with who you are, right? Mm-hmm. Just be tall and stand tall and be proud. And I've always had a mouth on me since I was really young. My dad used to tell us jokes, mostly to my mom, while we were in the backseat driving to Florida to visit our grandparents, and he would think I wouldn't remember because I was like six. And then I would repeat the joke that had the punchline about a woodpecker and two trees. It's the best piece of ash I've had my pecker in a long time.
Oh, no.
My grandparents. And he'd be like, well, so I've always had a mouth. I've always been into putting on shows and entertaining. So I think there was just a natural confidence that came with being an athlete, being super tall, coming from a family that really owned and embraced, you know, being smart and wanting to be good and achieve. So I was a super high achiever. And, there were little moments throughout where I think I realized that there was a real feminist growing without me knowing it.
Yeah.
You know, there was at Cornell, everybody on various sports was given a Cornell LSU shirt and shorts, but none of the track team practiced in it because it just didn't make sense for a lot of our events to have baggy shorts, especially like long jump, right? You're going to be picking sand out of your butt all day if you don't have, you know, leggings on.
Yep.
So we would go after practice into the varsity locker room or varsity weight room, and at one point we were told we would have to change in between because our outfits, our spandex, was distracting the men's team.
Oh, no.
And I was like, oh, hell no. That's not our job. You focus on your stuff. It's not up to us to not distract you. You get your own, you know what, together.
Mm-hmm.
And so I put together a petition. I had all these different women from different teams sign it and say that that was BS and dropped it.
Mm-hmm.
You know, so I think that there's moments without me really knowing it. I think I've always been very defensive of female athletes, of women being allowed to be funny and smart and high achieving. And then it wasn't until I really got into this industry and realized how many people are deeply offended by the fact that I just want to be in sports. I haven't even said anything yet. It's my mere presence. It's that I have the voice of a female, or that I look like a female, or that I am a woman, and I believe that I am allowed a space here, that that makes them so angry. And that's when I first really started to understand how many people are still stuck, like wanting to limit women in so many ways. And so I really, over the last, I would say, like 7 years or 8 years, especially working with ESPNW, which is a branch of ESPN that's geared toward female athletes and sports fans, have decided that that my career and my life is not so much about how famous and rich can I get doing this. It's about how many people can I influence and how can I change the industry for the better so that it's not just they're token women that are facilitating conversations between men, or even when we are given the right to have opinions and space for that, are we being reduced to bodies and being objectified because we're not the norm yet in the space. So, yeah, I think it was growing and building, but it started with a pretty good foundation, and then it ended with I don't like being told what to.
Great. You could have gotten into comedy. That's a very similar thing.
I did. I actually did the whole Sex City Conservatory in L.A. That's originally what I
did.
Moved out to L.A. for.
Oh, that's
was
hilarious.
Comedy. Yeah. I loved it, and I missed so much.
Yeah, well, and what I often say is, like, we train people up to disrespect, like, me and what I stand for. So, you know, because the producer at any certain time is the person making a decision, and all about sort of challenging authority. So what the hell am I doing? I'm curious, too, about this idea of, like, the talent pipeline. So this is both, like, okay, so you evolved a POV. My daughter's evolving a POV, which is very shaped by the time they live in, which is very different from the time I grew up. And you wrote an article, which I'm quoting, where you say pipelines exist in every business for white males, but we need to create pipelines for everyone else. This is so true. And the thing that won't make it happen is by just saying we need to have it happen by establishing a quota. We need sort of broad, you know, views around what equity means and what inclusion means. And I wonder if you see that changing, or is it still like, man, this is a wall that we're not even close to getting over?
I think it's getting better for sure, in part because a lot more people are forcing the conversation. I think in the many ways that social media is damaging and awful, it also has given voice to so many people without having to get to a space where somebody of power has to assign them a voice, right?
Mm-hmm.
So it used to be that you'd hear columnists or newspaper writers or magazine writers, and they would have to get there by way of that pipeline that you said.
Mm-hmm.
Now there's ways for people to really elevate voices of people of color or women and say, we need to work on this. We need to make this better. And I think you're right, because just saying you want to fill a quota, while it helps to start by reaching out to people, I think particularly comedy is a great place to know that the most confident of comedians are not always the best, right? There are some very delusional people who will stroll into a comedy club with zero self-awareness and would give themselves top billing and would take 20 minutes on stage and be the worst and be 100% certain that they had earned it, they were owed that.
Mm-hmm.
And so you can't just give the job to the one person who shows up for it, because that's actually more damaging. If you know, and that's why it was problematic early on when sports companies were hiring just beautiful model-looking women who didn't all do the work. And that is not to say that any beautiful model-looking woman who's in sports doesn't do the work, because unfortunately there's still a lot of hiring that you know, benefits TV visual mediums that have beautiful women, but they're working hard. They're often Ivy League graduates who are also former Olympians. Like, some of the women in my industry are so freaking talented, and they are so well-credentialed, but people assume by first looking at them, oh, she got her job because she's hot, or she slept with someone. Oh, wait, she actually sounds like she knows it. You know, it takes a while,
right?
Which is an unfair approach, but it can be damaging to hire people that are not the best for the job because they're the only ones that showed up. So it's about filling a quota. It's about realizing that you are, why in the world would you, if you wanted to run a successful company, give yourself just a percentage of all of the people available? You should be hoping and looking amongst all that could possibly be there. And so it is about creating pipelines. It's not about waiting for them to come to you because, you know, I look at sports radio. If you're a woman or even a person of color and you're listening to sports radio in almost any market, you're not going to think that there's space for you because it is literally lineups that are almost entirely just straight white dudes.
Yep.
From 7 a.m. to 7 p.m., everywhere you go. And so if you come to me and you say, I'm a program director and it stinks, there's no women applying, there's no people of color, well, then you have to go out and find them. Go to broadcast majors, go to colleges, go to places where people are coming to hear and network. And it's a lot more work, sure, but the end goal is to get the best, and you're not going to find it if you just keep hiring people who look exactly like you and who show up because they feel like it's a space for them.
So one of the nerdy things I get to do now, since I stepped down from producing on a day-to-day level, is I do a lot of work with academics and sort of co-run this institute at the University of Chicago that studies behavioral science and improvisation. Two things you said that I have science behind them. One is the idea of inclusion as a form, there's science around this, to avoid groupthink, to avoid bias, all these biases we have. And that there's a great new book called Radical Inclusion by Ori Brofman and Martin Dempsey, who's the former Joint Chief of Staff, which is like the only way in this sort of fact-challenged world we live in to get to truth is by having massive inclusion, which also means you need to be talking to your enemies. And this
100%.
And this is a place that I get so depressed in my social media feed because, like, of course I'm a lefty liberal. I'm like a comedy theater guy in Chicago. Of course that's who I am. But, suddenly my friends on the left are starting to talk. They're talking in a way where I'm like, oh, you're not hearing or listening to someone else or even giving a full account of who they are. And this confidence thing you talked about, there's also some science around that specifically to comedy. A friend of mine who's a professor did a study and recognized that people who use comedy, even unsuccessfully, do appear confident. That is true to all people. But when the comedy is bad or mean or used wrong, they don't appear competent. So that's where they lose people. And I've seen that play out in the boardroom, right? Like the jerk uses that, and you're like, oh yeah, well everyone's laughing at your joke because you have some status, your confidence is showing in that way, but no one thinks you're competent because your comedy is not successful.
Yeah, 100%. And there's the diversity of voices, the inclusion thing was really interesting in our field a couple years ago when the running back Ray Rice was caught on tape knocking out his then fiance. And ESPNW already existed. There were a handful of powerful female voices already at the company that were called upon to talk about this issue in nuanced ways. And it was a really important moment for ESPN, while other places were scrambling with a panel of seven former NFL players in one broadcast to have conversations about it and perpetuating awful stereotypes and speaking from places of really no education or knowledge on the subject. And it was a very stark reminder to a lot of places that that if you have the same voices in a room, it's going to result in some real blind spots. And I use the example a lot because it happens all the time without it being quite such an obvious topic.
Right.
And people don't notice it as much when they don't realize, like, we're speaking from a place that, and we, it happens a lot on sports radio where we'll be like, oh, why didn't they, they're talking about a comment from an NBA player about light skin versus dark skin, and it's two white guys. Why didn't they call up a black guy and ask about this cultural idea that's in the NBA? Or they're talking about this woman getting hired. Why didn't they just call up a woman and ask her for her opinion? Like, I think we forget that a lot, how just bringing in someone with better experience is super useful.
Michael Lewis has a book out called The Undoing Project, and one of the sort of origin stories is about, and I'm forgetting his name, but he was the Houston Rockets, I think, GM, who, after taking a course in behavioral science, forbids scouts from comparing players of the same race. If you had to compare and say
Daryl Morey, probably
it's Daryl Morey. Yeah. So he was like, and It came out of the Steph Curry thing, because like no one knew what that looked like, because he didn't look like what that's supposed to be. So it's like you got to compare him to a white player, and it immediately makes you sort of nudge yourself out of your own bias, because we all have this, and it's not
totally.
That's the I think that's the ultimate problem here is. So especially white liberals, they're the worst on this. They're so you call them racist, that is the worst thing you can possibly do. But we all have these sort of biases that play out in a variety of ways, quite frankly, in ways that go well beyond sort of gender and race. They go into a lot of weird areas. And if you can just sort of allot for, I probably think this way because I'm in these patterns, let's get me out of those patterns. You know what gets that you out of the patterns is when you're talking to someone who looks different than you.
Totally. Have you heard of Project Implicit?
No, tell me about it.
Okay, Project Implicit is this amazing study or project by Harvard, and essentially you can find out your social attitudes or your biases, even that are sort of at the subconscious level. Mm-hmm. So whether you have certain associations with race or gender or sexual orientation, you take these little tests online at Project Implicit, and it'll tell you if you have a tendency to associate certain people with certain things, and you're doing it really quickly.
Yep.
So it like one test will say, okay, on the left, if you see a name that's stereotypically Hispanic, and on the right, you see a positive quality, then click this button. If you see a Hispanic name and a negative quality, click a different button. And you're supposed to go really fast. And you find out the number of times that your brain makes the opposite, right?
Yep.
Having to do with gender, any number of things. And so it's a really powerful tool, especially, like you said, for white liberals who believe themselves to be completely bias-free and are completely, like, removing the idea that, you know, years of social, just existing in our society and being surrounded by like-minded people might affect them in ways that even aren't conscious of. That's a really interesting study, because I even found ways that I was like, oh, no! The way I think that, and it's not really about you thinking it when you have a chance. It's about what pops into your head, and how do you then realize that you need to adjust it.
Totally. Oh, that's fascinating. I'm going to check it out. All right. So before I ask you for a yes and story, which is how we end the podcast, So you work in broadcast media about sports. And if you really sort of step back and think about this, oh, my God, you got into basically two fields that are undergoing massive effing change. So broadcasting, of course. I mean, I'm sitting in the studio at WGN in the Tribune Tower wondering when Sinclair Media is going to come in and I have to leave, that's going to be the case. And then
we'll read a script.
Yeah, I'm not reading that script. They cannot. They'll have Seb Gorka do it. It'll be fine. And then you've got like football, right? And so, I think about like my son, who's a big guy. They had flag football. He went to a Waldorf school, said he didn't really have a football team. But I don't think I would have let him play. And I think that is a way that's going to go in high school. I think colleges are going to have a very big problem. And this isn't just a football. It's boxing and there's technology and all those stuff. But do you allow yourself to look at this and go, man, I'm inside something that will change very, very much? Or are you able to just go, that's what's going on, but I've got a story to do, so I'm going to do my story?
It's a little of both, right? It's making sure that I am very grateful, but also realistic about the current position I'm in, and that any time it could be ripped out from under me. There's been a lot of layoffs in our industry, not just at ESPN. They publicize when they're at ESPN because we're the worldwide leader, but unfortunately, all over the place, whether it's websites or newspapers or TV and radio, because of the changing landscape and because of trying to figure out how to monetize the internet in ways that's meaningful. So I'm very grateful and aware. I'm not off buying any Maseratis or anything. Trying to make sure that because especially in my industry, you go contract to contract, right? So, and also, unfortunately, being a woman in the industry, I have to worry about my Amy Schumer last fuckable day, as she said, right?
Sure
that like people are liking me for something other than being a remotely attractive woman, you know, at a certain age. So, so I think about it, and then I also think. I try my best to be someone who will be able to adapt, right? And it helps that I am a writer who does radio and TV, because that kind of leaves me open for any number of ways to express myself.
Right.
And my opinion is that it's smart to adjust, evolve with the information that we get, right? When you dig in your heels too hard to some long-held belief or narrative that you've taught yourself, it's really hard to allow yourself to get off that. And you can't do that anymore. You can't do that with the NFL. Mm-hmm. And so, you know, I feel for people who are still digging in their heels and saying, there's not enough information about CTE and concussions for me to think anything about the sport. You know, this sport's been ruined. Like, they're taking all the big hits out. And you're like, dude,
yeah,
evolve or die. Right,
right. It's gladiator shit.
I think that that's part of it. And then I think it is hard to realize when your personal tastes don't necessarily align with the way things are changing. I was an English major, I'm a writer. I love reading incredibly thoughtful, well-written pieces. I'm down for a long read. I'll read a book. I'll read the New Yorker. Like, there's plenty of people that don't want that. They want their information in bite-sized Snapchat videos.
Yeah.
And just because that's not where I go to get it doesn't mean I can't just ignore that, right?
Mm-hmm.
So I think you have to be open to the ways that your industry is changing without necessarily, like, selling out on the things that matter to you, and hope that there is a little bit of both. So, yeah, it's hard, but there's also some really incredible ways that sports are evolving, and there's people having really honest conversations about how we've kind of mythologized sport to be the place where you learn all of the best lessons and become the best people. And if that were the case, then every professional athlete would be the best person that exists. Every college coach who's a leader of young men would be just a great, you know, beacon of ethics and morality. And we know that to be wholly untrue.
Right.
We're having much more honest conversations about how, like, the commodification and the way we deal with sports as this massive billion-dollar industry, as if it's full of amateurs who are playing for the love of the game and good people who are learning about teamwork and whatever, bullshit.
Yeah.
So I think we're just doing a better job of being honest with ourselves about all the wonderful ways that sports ties together and all the ways it allows us to have conversations about things that many people otherwise wouldn't discuss, but also be honest about really damaging things that sports kind of allows for as well.
Yeah, I went, the women's national soccer team was here, and I grew up, I played soccer, and I took my daughter, and I was like, oh my God, this is the most diverse audience for any event I've ever been at in my life.
Right.
It was queer. It was Hispanic. It was Polish. It was, you know, I mean, it was everything. And there were men and women and older women and younger women. And it was really like I was like, okay, so here's a sports thing that I can get behind. And I love this game anyway. And then thinking about radio too, like, you know, we've been talking about the death of radio forever. And I know my dad was a radio guy in the heyday, right? And he got out just as the you know, it was going the other way. But who would have thought that podcasting would become this thing, which is
and
more like a huge, and it's
well, you can carry it with you everywhere, right?
It's long form.
It's just radio on your phone.
Yep. So I think audio, the idea of audio communication is not going away. Some of the formats are going to change. We always end the podcast asking our guests for a yes and story. And you know this because you took the classes at Second City, which is to make something out of nothing. You can't do it by saying no. And you can't say yes, but you have to say yes and. And I'm wondering if there's a moment in your life or work when you normally would have said no, but instead said yes and.
Okay, so you actually sent this before as the one thing. You know, we're not going to tell you anything we'll talk about, but just keep this in mind. And I have to tell you that I struggled because I am a come-from-a-place-of-yes person.
Yeah.
I am a up-for-anything. You know, the only things that I consistently say no to are things I put in my mouth. Drinks I don't like, food I don't like, and drugs I don't want. And that's pretty much it, right? Like, if you ask me, the most oftentimes I say no, it's like, oh, no, thanks, I don't like shrimp, or,
right.
Oh, no, I don't drink tequila. And other than that, it's like, sure, why not? So I struggled a little. But something that I thought of is I've gotten really busy, and I'm trying to balance saying yes to things that still matter to me, whether that's meeting for coffee with some aspiring young one who wants to get into my business,
right,
or going on a podcast that I love, or, you know, doing things that are not technically my job, but that I want to still do. And so I make time for them. But especially when I was getting ready for my wedding, and I've done this probably 5 times, where I'll put myself on a strict thing where I say, okay, for the next month, you're not allowed to say yes to anything because you have trouble saying no and end up being so stressed out.
Yep.
So especially leading up to my wedding, I was on one of those, don't say yes to anything. You don't have time. Stop saying yes. Send them an email that says, oh my God, I'd love to do this. Please message me. after this date and see if I'm available. And I got a message from an acquaintance of my husband's who I might have met maybe 5 years before that for like 5 minutes, but I didn't remember. And he was going to do this project that was trying to shine a light on the abuse that specifically women in sports get online. Mm-hmm. And I was going to say no because I had said that I had to say no. And then I said, you know what? As dumb as it sounds, I had to do a photo shoot later in that day for something. So I was like, well, I'm already going to have my makeup done. So I might as well just, you know, it won't add any time. I'll go there for 45 minutes. And I'll do this project that's in a topic I care about and whatever. You know, who knows what this is, but it seems like it's on a good topic. And that ended up being the Peabody Award-winning More Than Mean video.
Oh, my God.
Went viral and has
that was More Than
millions
Mean.
Millions. Yeah.
Wow.
So, yeah. And, again, it's not normally something I would necessarily say no to, but in that moment, I did yes and it. Yes, and now I've done it, and it blew up. I have created, instead of more time off, I spent then... You know, the following 2 weeks before my wedding, doing countless appearances on every radio station, TV show, news broadcast, and then spent that next year magically and wonderfully going to all of these different award shows, the Bodies and the Gracies and the Cleos and all these great, amazing opportunities because it was so well received and it became such a viral sensation. So, yeah, I mean, it's a good one in terms of telling yourself if you yes and something. It could end up being, you know, one of your best things that you've done.
That's a pretty killer yes and story. And I'll say too, some of the misunderstanding around yes and because you do need to make yourself more less complex. You have to say no to like too many projects because multitasking is a myth. All this stuff is very, very true. I think the power of yes and comes in that sort of like 5 minutes at the beginning of a board meeting. Or I think it's in situations where we can connect with other human beings. And I think that those are the ones we rarely regret.
100%.
So I do that, too. If someone, you know, says to me, will you take, I did it this morning. Someone's like, I'm stuck in my career. Will you take 20 minutes? I'm like, yeah, I'll take 20 minutes because that's what people did for me. And it meant the world. And so we all need to be doing that to each other. So I appreciate it. And you yes and being on the podcast. So Sarah Spain, thanks for coming on the show.
Thanks for having me.
Well, I've been working in a coal mine.